On the Record with Gavin Riley on News Talk.
Really busy morning coming on, so I'll take a quick whistle-stop look at what's on the front pages of this morning's papers. I'll start with the Sunday Independent, because it and the Irish Mail on Sunday, their front-page stories go pretty well hand in hand. The Sunday Independent is warning us this morning that house prices could reach Celtic Tiger levels, according to two leading property experts, as Taoiseach Leo Varadkar last night promised more house building and admitted that home ownership is out of reach for far too many. As the government set a fresh target of up to 40,000 new homes a year in order to reach 70% home ownership by the end of the decade, economist Jim Power says the housing market is currently on fire. Those are his quotes. And prices are around 14% below the Celtic Tiger peak. Housing lecturer Morgan Sir and mortgage expert Carl Dieter both say that they now expect price levels to go to levels not seen since 2006. Carl Dieter suggests this will end in tears. That sobbing you can hear in the background is Aoife Moore, who's sobbing about future home affordability. We'll come to her in a moment. Also, we're told on the front page of the Sunday Independent that a government probe is underway to establish if mica or pyrite, which currently causes masonry blocks to crumble, is in four more counties after cracks started appearing in dozens of homes. We know that the current remediation scheme is available to homeowners in Donegal and Mayo, but now the department is investigating whether there are also defective blocks in counties Dublin, Clare and Sligo, and a fourth county, which is understood by the Sunday Independent to be County Limerick. That comes as the government will be seeking tens of millions from building firms, insurers and financial institutions to recoup some of the costs that it's going to face now as a result of that remediation scheme, which is estimated to be up to 1.5 billion euro. I said that those two front pages go hand in hand because when it comes to housing and affordability, the Irish Mail on Sunday doesn't carry very positive news either. 2025, before housing targets can be met, the government has been given a dire official warning that the housing crisis won't begin to get better. In other words, it's going to continue to get marginally worse until at least 2025. An internal analysis has told the COVID coalition chiefs, those are John Drennan's alliterative words, not mine, that they'll have to change tack significantly from their current housing policies to even make that deadline. In a bombshell document prepared for the Cabinet's Housing Subcommittee, the Taoiseach, Taoiseach and Housing Minister have been told of significant obstacles they will face in meeting their housing commitments, including demand-side policies will create a house price inflation, the lack of builders, manpower and materials to build houses will limit the economy's ability to rebuild, and that the government needs to activate building sites that have already got planning permission to allow extra homes to come on stream. All of this coming as Leo Varadkar yesterday promised new plans to try and build 40,000 homes a year. As you'll hear in his interview with me, which we'll broadcast just after 12 o'clock, he says that that is not yet the government's target, it's only Fine Gael's one. We'll see exactly how that translates into coalition policy. The front page of the Sunday Times this morning says cross-border trade rockets thanks to Brexit. Well, it might be thanks more to the Northern Ireland Protocol than thanks to Brexit itself, but we're told that cross-border business is booming post-Brexit as the EU imposes more than 500 checks a day on the transfer of goods between Great Britain and Northern Ireland. A British government source admitted that trade patterns have shifted since the 1st of January as the impact of the so help me God so-called sausage war kicks in. Some chilled meats preparations such as sausages that had been imported from Britain are now being sourced on the island of Ireland instead. The value of British exports to Ireland this year is 39% lower than last year and 44% lower than 2018. Trade between Northern Ireland and the Republic is significantly up and trending far beyond historic levels. Also on the front page of the Sunday Times this morning, the Office of the Director of Corporate Enforcement is seeking access to around 1,200 of John Delaney's communications with his lawyers under a crime/fraud exception following a ruling that the messages are not legally privileged. As you'll know, usually correspondence between a person and their legal representatives is usually privileged. But on Friday, the judge Leonie Reynolds heard that a process of cataloguing 270,000 emails seized by Gardaí in February last year from the account of the former FAI chief executive has concluded. Barristers appointed by the court found that 1,100 or so of the 2,805 emails, which Delaney's lawyers had tagged as legally privileged, were not in fact privileged. And also the Sunday Times tells us on the MICA story that almost half of all the houses assessed so far under the MICA redress scheme are being recommended for demolition. That's much higher than the 1 in 3 that had been originally indicated during the week. And finally, now the Business Post. State plans new winter boosting campaign as Pfizer supplies hit record levels. Good news for the 39-year-olds who are able to register online for their vaccine this morning. The state has begun early planning for a winter revaccination campaign against COVID-19. This comes as new data suggests the Delta variant accounted for 5% of Ireland's confirmed cases in the past week, while vaccine registration for the 35 to 39 year old age cohort opens today, and the HSE expects to administer a record number of up to 330,000 vaccines this week. Also on the front page of the Business Post, and we'll leave on this, The timetable to end the existing direct provision system by 2024 is unrealistic, and costings attached to the project are too low, according to a new series of warnings raised by senior civil servants. Officials within the Department of Public Expenditure and Reform are likely to put pressure now on Roderick O'Gorman, the Children's Minister, whose department is overseeing the implementation of the new plan. They say that the cost of running the new system is judged as too low, and that the development costs associated with building new reception centres are being underestimated. Under the planned new scheme, asylum seekers will spend a maximum of 4 months in custom-built state-owned reception centres before they move on to other housing. And that is all detailed by Killian Woods in the Business Post. We're joined, as I mentioned, by Aoife Moore, political correspondent with the Irish Examiner, and by Fergus Finlay, former chief executive of Barnardo's, now a columnist with the Irish Examiner and a member of the board of directors of the HSE. Thank you both for coming in to see me this morning. Aoife, we'll start with yourself, because I mentioned the front pages of the Sunday Independent and the Mail on Sunday painting a fairly bleak picture when it comes to housing affordability, and you're already there. Yeah, quivering in the corner of the studio.
It's just more of the same that we already knew. You know, people my age, and I am obviously very privileged, I have a good job, and it's owning a house in Dublin is so far out of my reach. I do not have wealthy parents. I pay extortionate rent in an investor-funded flat. So
Buy into the Conor Skean idea that you could just go and get some job elsewhere.
Just love somewhere else. Unfortunately, I have to work in Leinster House, so I need to be around. But the other thing too, and we saw this at the Fine Gael Ardèche last night, Leo Varadkar saying they wanted to build 40,000 houses a year. Fine Gael always come out, they constantly talk about housing, and I don't understand the political sense in that, because it is where they are weakest. They continually bring it up, and it's where they're weakest, and they continually bring it up. And I don't understand the point in it, because the other thing is they've been in government for 10 years. If you ask people in the street, what is the difference between Owen Murphy's housing policy and what is the difference between Dara O'Brien's housing policy? I don't think many people could tell you. So every week in the Sunday papers and all the papers, we hear that prices are going up, that rents are going up, that housing is getting more and more scarce. I saw an advertised house last night that was something like 235,000 over the asking price when it went to auction.
Yeah.
So it gets incredibly depressing, and I do not see any change coming anytime soon. I wish I could be more optimistic, but I really can't.
When you say that you don't understand why Fine Gael keep raising this because you think it's the area in which they've been weakest, is it not really the responsibility, though, of those who are in government to recognise that there are certain areas in which they've completely failed and that they need to do better or to be more ambitious? So on that front, you could say, well, isn't it better that Leo Varadkar is talking about housing shortages rather than pretending they don't exist?
I suppose so, and I think obviously we are heading towards a by-election as well, and maybe they are a bit concerned about it, and they know that they're weakest, and that's why they have to keep talking about it. But I would say, and the polling shows this, that is also where they are least trusted. You know, Fine Gael or not, the party people think are going to solve the housing crisis. So I suppose that could be a part of it. You know, they need to recognise that this is where they're weakest, but I don't understand politically why they keep harping on about housing when people don't trust what they're saying.
There's an awful lot written in today's papers about Mike, and we'll come to that in a few minutes' time. But firstly, Fergus, any reflections that you have on house prices hitting Celtic Tiger levels, or it being 2025 before we hit the current targets?
Well, that'd be good news. I mean, that'd be very good news. I was very struck by the language in John Drown's piece about bombshell reports and so on. If we could fix the housing crisis by 2025, that's only 4 years away. And that'd be brilliant.
Well, that wouldn't be fixing the crisis. That would only be meeting the current demand, because that would be meeting the target of 33,000 a year.
Wouldn't that be a wonderful start?
But every year that you don't meet the target is, of course, further arrears to build up.
But wouldn't that be a wonderful start? And we're nowhere near it. I mean, I find this mind-boggling. I just don't understand
which
it.
Bit?
The fact that the government have failed so badly to start building. There are several regeneration programmes across the city of Dublin, which don't just offer the chance of much better housing for existing communities, but also the chance of much more housing. You know, there are vacant sites across the city of Dublin, and all those projects are stalled. They're completely stalled. I don't
those
know
are the ones in which planning permission has been granted, but they just haven't done anything about it.
Teresa's Gardens, Oliver Bond, Dolphin House, they're all sitting there. I'm very heavily involved with the one in Dolphin House. It's been going on for 10 years now, and we've got a phase and a bit done. If the government was serious, if the department was serious, they'd be driving this. They'd be insisting on it. There are massive wrangles going on about things like the John Player Will site on the South Circular Road, for example, which have not been resolved, but which hold the hope of hundreds of apartments and houses. social and affordable. The government seems to me to be tied up in a completely ideological fixation between what social means, what affordable means, what cost rental means. They want different models. All of their models, with the exception of the social housing model, all of their models insist on the involvement of the private sector, insist on the involvement of private developers.
Rewind a bit then. So tell me about Dolphin House, because I don't know very much about the Dolphin House project, but I'm already struck by the idea that you say this has been ongoing for a decade or more and you've only got one and a bit phases done. So tell me about this whole project.
Dolphin House was listed for regeneration, as were a number of others, Trees, Gardens and so on. And they were all going to be done by the famous PPP model, public-private partnership. Private sector was going to get involved and rebuild and put in decent facilities, etc., etc. The minute the ASRI mentioned the word recession, way back when, 2008, 2007, whenever it was, the private sector just walked away completely, And all of those projects were abandoned and fell back onto the state. And there they sat. Eventually, in the case of Dalton House, we began and completed phase one, and we have now completed a senior citizens complex, both of which are absolutely fantastic. Now, they're beset by some teething problems. Antisocial behaviour is a significant problem in all of those communities. But notwithstanding that, they are projects to what has been done is a project to be proud of. But the rest of it is sitting there. We're at loggerheads all the time, and I don't blame or criticise Dublin City Council in relation to this. Somebody somewhere is saying to them, "No, you can't proceed. No, you can't proceed." For example,
so what grounds are they coming up with? Is it financial concerns or is it urban heritage?
As one example, the department has made it very clear that they will not, under any circumstances, fund the development of community facilities within these communities. So you're talking about communities where 1,000 people live, where they're, and where it is proposed that more people will live. And the only way to fund community facilities, according to the department, in these communities is to sell some of the land for private investment and earmark that money for community development. That happened in a sort of a way in Fatima, which is now Herberton. They got in, as it were, ahead of the collapse of the economy. But in all of the other communities, they're stuck. They're stuck by ideological log jams. They're also stuck by the fact that there's a tiny planning department in Dublin City Council. There's a tiny architects department in Dublin City Council. Mm. They haven't been. They don't have the resources.
Is that an issue that they don't have the resourcing to scope out and improve all these things?
When somebody decided, and I've always thought it was Charlie McCreevy, that housing was a job for the private sector, way back when. All the local authorities around the country were effectively starved of the resources in those areas, in planning, in architect, in design, etc.
So is that a Kelty Tiger hangover then, that they downsized all these apartments
and they haven't been addressed? They haven't been adequately addressed. There's some progress, but it's painstakingly small. And when you set it against the commitment again and again and again by politicians that we're going to do this and we're going to do that and we're going to build X, Y and a Z, but in fact, they're building nothing, absolutely nothing. You can accuse me of exaggeration, but if I am, I'm not exaggerating.
If it's a scheme
much,
that you're intimately
nothing.
Aware with, then you have a better understanding of this more than most. I do want to move on to Micah, but just is there a specific bottleneck there that it all hangs on? Is there like, there's no silver bullet to fix this stuff quickly?
Well, I think it's ideological myself. I think that the language that is used, the language of social and affordable, the language of cost rental, the language of is all a way of keeping this idea that housing is for the private sector alive. And I've no problem with the private sector building houses for people who want to buy them. I've no problem with that at all.
As long as the public sector does it too.
As long as the public sector does it too. If we need houses, we got to build them. And a government that keeps saying, oh, we must, when they're actually not. They're doing nothing. You cannot point to a single project in Ireland that's going gangbusters, a single housing project. Whether you're talking about Darndale, whether you're talking about Fingal, you can't look at a single project. The only one that I can see is Cherrywood, which of course is private sector housing for the private sector and so on. That seems to now be going apace. But in terms of the public sector, I can't find a single project anywhere which you could say, oh, that's flying. I'd love to see that. I'm dying to see the finish of that.
If there's any public sector projects that listeners think are actually going gangbusters and would like to correct any of the rest of us in studio, because I don't think you or I, if you can think of any ones that are really zooming up in there now, do let us know. 53106 for your texts, or on the record on the record NT is the hashtag on Twitter. As I said, there's a lot written in today's papers about Mica. There's a lot written about all sorts of different housing things, like estate agents who want buyers' financial data for viewings, which seems really dystopian. Whole question mark. Killian Woods actually has a very good spread today in the Business Post around the problem with vacant homes. But I do want to focus on Mica because it's been a big political topic of the week. Aoife, there's a lot written in today's papers across all the titles. Anywhere that you want to start or anything that jumped out for you?
Well, as a dairy person, like most dairy people, I was half reared in Donegal, and my dad works in Donegal. We live on the border, so I know quite a lot of people who have in some way been affected by the Mica crisis. And I think as well, what I have found this week is that the public opinion is so behind these people. You know, we saw the crowds outside the CCD there during the week, and you know, there's this chat now. Dara Cleary is saying that he's going to resign if it's not 100%, and Mark McSharry said the same thing. And Mark McSharry made a good point, actually, on News to Talk. He was saying that, you know, if it was good enough when it was in Meath and Leinster and Dublin with a pay rate scandal for 100%, then why is it not good enough for 100% for Donegal? And now we're here in Limerick and parts of Clare as well. So, yeah, the government, I actually was there when the Mica group confronted the housing minister outside at Leinster House, and they basically said, look, it's 100% or bust. He said that they have this working group, but it'll be the 31st of July. There's this 31st of July deadline on it, and he's going to come back to them. But, you know, in and around Leinster House, they're kind of all saying behind the scenes, it's not going to be 100%. It's not going to happen. So I don't know how the government gets itself out of this, because it is not the fault of these people.
Could it find itself in a certain level of damned if it doesn't? Well, I suppose it already does. It's damned if it doesn't, damned if it doesn't, because, you know, there'll be a lot of other people who will wonder why it is that the taxpayer ends up on the hook for all of this. That, you know, the taxpayer is not the person who provided, you know, faulty blocks. It's not the builder. It's not the insurer. And people will wonder why it comes down to taxpayers from all across the country to fund a faulty project that they had no responsibility for.
Yeah, and that's what people are saying to me. You know, my friends who aren't involved in politics but are watching this on the news, the first question they always ask is, why does the taxpayer have to pay for it? Why are the other people not involved? And even when you hear the politicians talking, they're given very wishy-washy answers about how they're going to go after the quarries and they're going to go after this person and the next person. The fact of the matter is, they're saying that our building regulations were strong enough. They obviously weren't, because this wouldn't have happened if they were. So, you know, they are, the government saying, oh, we're going to go after this person, that person. But I think it really remains to be seen, because I think they know they don't have much of a case.
I imagine, Fergus, given the delays in some other housing projects and construction in general, you wouldn't have very much optimism that an urgent 6-week deadline for some sort of proposal on this is ever going to be met.
Well, the only reason to have a working group, I mean, there is, like, there's no, the issue of principle is straightforward. You don't need a working group to decide, have these people been badly treated or not? We all know they have been appallingly badly treated. Just imagine how we'd all feel ourselves if we'd invested everything we have in building the home in which we wanted to raise our families and then discovered 2 years later that it was a place of danger for your kids because the walls were falling down. Like, how would you feel about that? And how angry would you be about that? But the only reason, I guess, to have some kind of interdepartmental group is to figure out how much the size of the total bill is and where do we get it from? Because the state has to take responsibility here in exactly the same way as the state has to take responsibility.
So do you think it's likely that the state will end up meeting all the costs up front and then in some interminably lengthy chase in the forecourts with insurers or builders trying to get some of it back?
I don't care whether they chase the insurers or the builders, and I don't care how long that takes. I think the state is going to have to figure out whether they need to borrow another $1.5 billion and go and do it. And you know, that's not beyond... It's not beyond our capacity. It's not beyond our capacity. Like, we've done this kind of thing before in the past. You know, this is the country that electrified the government, the political system that electrified Ireland, that built dams, that, you know, everything we've needed to do in the past, we've done it. We've always said at the time, oh, my God, we couldn't possibly afford to do this. We did it. And somehow or other, the heavens never fell in. If it's going to cost $1.5 billion to fix this problem, it has to be found and spent. And you know, and if it takes 20 years for the government to pay that back, so be it.
Eva, very brief before we go to a break.
Could I just say, we have a habit in this country of waiting until the worst possible thing happens before we take any action. And my major fear is that one of these houses or one of these buildings, you know, there's a school involved. Why do we have to wait until a block falls off and seriously injure somebody or somebody dies? Let's not let that happen. Let's get to work now, as Fergus said. Find the money and fix it before the worst possible thing happens.
It won't be easy to be done, but something has to be done. Haven't had any suggestions in yet on public projects that are going gangbusters, but Fine Gael councillor David McManus has pointed out that approved housing bodies provided 3,312 new social homes last year, which was 42% of national output.
They did, and approved housing bodies, the senior citizens complex in Dolphin that I talked about earlier, built by Fold, an approved housing body, and they are doing a fantastic job. But they can't work to the scale that is needed. They just can't do it.
Eamon has been touching Twitter and says, until the government bans vulture funds from buying up houses and apartments, the housing crisis will never end. And Anthony has been in touch on Twitter to say, no one will say it, but the reason for spiralling house prices is down to a deliberate strategy to maintain prices by decision-making politicians and their buddies in big business who are hit badly by investing in property pre-crash. It's the only conclusion, he says, he can come to. I will not pretend, Aoife, that I understand the hearts and minds of those in the loyalist and unionist communities, but I still can't quite get over what Edwin Poots thought there was to be gained by going ahead with the formation of, or the appointment of a new First Minister on Thursday, when there appeared to be literally nothing in it for him other than getting his protege into a very fancy chair.
I think what happened is that, pardon the rhyme here, but I think Edwin Poots got too big for his boots. I think he ousted Arlene Foster. I think he was overly confident. And it appeared to be not only that he was going to go ahead and nominate his protege, the issue seemed to be that he was going to go ahead and nominate his protege without talking to anyone else in his party. You know, that's what all the coverage of this said is that they were taken aback that he did not even discuss with his party. He was so confident was he that this was going to he was the leader and they were just all going to take it in their stride.
But then even when the writing was on the wall, when he had that meeting on Thursday morning and that he famously walks out in front of Sammy Wilson while Sammy Wilson is complaining about the deal
the
that's
been
done. As the
vote is being taken,
and he walks out to ignore the outcome of the vote to go ahead with it anyway. Why be so big-headed about it? I can't even think of a more polite way, but why be so
arrogant.
So strong-willed? Arrogant, I guess.
So arrogant. Yeah, I think he thought, well, I'm only in it 3 weeks. They're not going to get rid of me now. You know, you have to remember, he's only the fourth leader they've ever had, and I don't think he ever thought they were going to oust him after 3 weeks. And I think he painted himself into a corner, and he wasn't willing to listen to the rank and file, and off he went, and he, the outcome was the outcome.
There is an awful lot of coverage, as you'd expect, in the Sunday papers today. Pieces by the likes of Henry MacDonald, who's written a lot in the Sunday Times, also by Newton Emerson and Justine McCarthy. There's Rodney Edwards with his usual pieces in the Sunday Independent, well worth the read. Daniel Murray and Deirdre Heenan in the Business Post too. Fergus, there's so much to pick from. Anything that stood out for you in the analysis this morning?
Well, there's an awful lot of revisionism going on. A couple of things that struck me when the day he resigned was that everything I read when Edwin Poots was chosen as leader of the DUP had two common threads. And all the experts, all the commentators, everyone, they all agreed on these two things. First, that he has some rather strange views. A man who believes that the world is no more than 6,000 years old and that was created in a week and all that kind of thing. To say that they're slightly old-fashioned views would be to perhaps understate it.
But
secondly,
is it relevant where you think the world came from 6,000 years ago?
Well,
the
second thing they all
now.
Said was, don't underestimate this man. He's a very, very canny politician. Now, to lose your party in 3 weeks requires a level of canniness that Lady Bracknell would have been mortified about. It is quite extraordinary. But the other thing that I have to say, and it hasn't really been mentioned very much, is This current row, the last row was about gay conversion. This current row is about the Irish language. It seems to me to be almost a perfect microcosm of the zero-sum politics that has bedeviled Northern Ireland for my entire adult life. I only win if you lose. That attitude. The fact that this has been brought about by Sinn Féin's insistence on Irish language rights now. I saw news item the other night on RT News, which interviewed the principal of a Gael school in Northern Ireland, a Gael school that looked very nice and very pleasant and so on. He talked about 7,000 to 9,000 children across Northern Ireland speaking the Irish language.
This in the context of 1.9 million, it's not really a huge
This
number.
Is what the government of Northern Ireland is being brought down over.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any kind of sense. You now have a complete, absolute and total mess, which I think, given the statement that came out from Loyalism the other day, does have within it the seeds of a very, very serious undermining of stability, peace, and so on.
Yeah, that statement from the Loyalist Communities Council was definitely quite unnerving from this side of the fence. Aoife, for those of us who can't quite understand why it's such a symbolic thing, can you explain, as somebody from what is termed Northern Ireland, I know that everyone even likes that terminology, but what is so symbolic for both the nationalist community, but also for the unionist community, about the Irish language even having any kind of official status at all? Because if it's not going to be like mandatory street signs, God forbid you'd have the Shankill Road being referred to as Bohor Shankill, because the name is already in Irish anyway. Mm-hmm. A lot of us don't understand why it's such a loaded thing. Take as long as you need.
Like, this row has been going on for ages, and the thing that is always brought up is that in other parts of the United Kingdom, in Wales and Scotland, they have similar protections for their indigenous languages, and the Irish-speaking community in the north say, why can't, if the DUP and the Union and the Unionists are so tied to the United Kingdom, why do you want to be separated from the United Kingdom on this issue? I believe, you know, the fact that I speak Irish doesn't take away anyone's Britishness. It doesn't damage their identity. But I think what it is, and this comes up a lot when you speak to unionist people, is that it's they feel that they are being forced into concessions all the time. A lot of, especially in loyalist communities, they feel that the Good Friday Agreement has left them behind.
Yeah. This is the crocodile's ethos, that you just keep giving them something and they come back for more.
I'm not saying this is right. I'm just saying that this is what they believe. I don't believe that someone else's equality takes away from yours, but they feel that they are forced into concessions all the time, and they use terms like second class citizens, and they feel, you know, if we start, you know, enshrining language laws and all that, that there it is removing the Britishness. This is what they think, removing the Britishness from Northern Ireland, and they feel like it's being eroded. And
but
to be honest,
isn't that again?
That's zero sum.
Yes,
that's just zero sum.
It is.
If you make some progress, it can only be at my expense.
Do you convince them otherwise?
I would point out that the Irish Language Act and all this, right, this is not a concession to Sinn Féin. The DUP already agreed to this. So Edwin Putt saying, you know, marching and saying, I'm going to do this, that and the other, and I'm going to walk away from the Irish Language Act. They already agreed to it.
Well, the St Andrews Agreement of 2006 also committed the British government to legislating for it. And I did find it slightly ironic that at a time when the British government is trying to step away from other commitments to do with Northern Ireland, that it's chosen now to implement one which is 15 years old. Still joined in studio by Fergus Finlay and by Aoife Moore, who was discussing her shock that people in the Republic have to pay for school books, which is a topic which might be addressed by United Ireland, which we could get to in a couple of minutes' time. But first, there's a lot written in today's papers about the concerns that have been raised about the governance and the operation of the new National Maternity Hospital, which people will know is being built on a site currently owned, or at least previously owned, by the Sisters of Charity at St Vincent's Hospital at Elm Park in Dublin. Justine McCarthy is writing today in the Sunday Times about hopes to end the site deadlock on that. We heard from the Tánaiste yesterday saying that there is a genuine desire on the part of the state to buy that site if it helps to iron out a lot of these concerns. Valerie Hanley is reporting that today in the Mail on Sunday as well. And Sunday Independent has a piece about how Kieran Mulvey is urging politicians to act on their plans for all of this. Fergus Finlay, I know that you're somewhat constrained in what you can say about all of this because you're a member of the board of directors of the HSE. So how about I maybe invite you to say whatever it is that you can about it?
Okay, this 15 minutes of silence is brought to you by the truth is there's a series of very complex and difficult decisions that have to be made. They haven't been made. They have to be made. They will involve government and they will involve politics, but in the first instance they will involve the board of the HSE, as somebody who will be involved in that decision making process, I can't comment on what, other than to say that this is an immensely complex and difficult set of decisions that require to be made, and it's very arcane, it's very abstruse.
Certainly is arcane. The one thing about all of this, Aoife, is that it took Leo Varadkar in Leader's Questions on Thursday to concede that there even was any sort of doubt about this at all, because up till now the government had been given the sense that everything was tickety-boo, that they'd had concessions about, you know, golden shares and about the handing over of the land and had been free from religious influence. I'm kind of curious that Leo Varadkar only in the last couple of days has conceded that maybe everything wasn't as sunny as the government had portrayed it to be.
Yeah, it seems to be one of these controversies that comes up a couple of times and then we don't talk about it then for another 4 years and then it's back on the table again. I know the government haven't decided whether they're going to vote for the Social Democrats or tabling a bill this week in the Oireachtas for 100% public ownership. Mm. And the soundings that I'm getting from Leinster House is they might let it pass.
The classic government tactic now, yeah. Just allowing things to pass and then allowing them to wither and go ignored anyway.
Yeah, wither and die on the vine. But as I say, it's something that should have been sorted. I know Fergus said this. It's something that should have been sorted a long time ago. We had Dr. Boylan, who left, obviously, the National Maternity Hospital, talking about, you know, that Micheál Martin shouldn't get in touch with the Vatican now and saying go over the nun's head and go straight to the Vatican, because he's saying that the nuns really won't have any say. It'll have to be the Vatican that will have the final say in it. But the sooner this is sorted, the better, because Harlow Street, as we know, is an old hospital and this needs to be sorted and we need the new hospital.
I'm always a little bit confused about the references to the Vatican, because I'm sure this is the case, but I don't understand why a religious institution which is not a formal part of the Catholic Church itself needs to get the approval of the church to sell something off. It's a little bit like a Gaelic Games themed pub deciding that it needs the approval of Croke Park before it can do renovations. It might be built in honour of and it might try to serve the glory of a particular cause, but if it's not part of the formal institution, I don't know why it needs Vatican approval to do anything.
All I can tell you about that, Gavin, and I say this with absolute complete sincerity, is I started my life as a trade union official. I represented young people who worked in hospitals and other care centres, many of which were run by orders of nuns. In 50 years of negotiation and public life, I have never had tougher negotiations than I had with the orders of nuns. They negotiate like flint. Mm. If I was the Vatican, I'd be terrified of taking on an order of nuns.
Well, then, put it this way then. Would you put the nuns in charge of negotiating the practicalities of a united Ireland so that Aoife Moore can keep her free school books and her NHS and we get to give them our welfare rates?
As long as they were on my side, I'd send the nuns anywhere. If they weren't on my side, no.
What did you make of some of the criticism about the timing of Leo Varadkar's intervention, and indeed, I suppose, about the timing of Leo Varadkar's intervention? Was it necessary to go and kick this rock again for the week that was in it?
Well, I'm not. There isn't a good time. There isn't a good time to say what he said. And probably, you know, if he had known what was about to unfold and what was actually unfolding, you know, he might have thought maybe I'll wait a week or two. but there's no harm in it either. Mm. There's no harm in saying, you know, I look forward to it and so on. I mean, there's a poll. Like the odd poll in some ways, but there's a poll in one of today's papers.
Yeah, I think it's the one in the Mail on Sunday, the one carried out by Ireland Thinks. This is the one about whether people want a united Ireland or not.
I'm always a bit dubious about polls that were conducted between 11 o'clock and 4 o'clock yesterday, but notwithstanding.
Well, no, I'm sure it's fairly scientifically robust anyway, but 51% of people told that poll that they were in favour or that they would vote in favour of a united Ireland were there to be a referendum in the next 5 years. 29% were against and 20% don't know. So there's just about a raw majority in favour of it, but if you were to exclude and the undecided, it would be about 71%.
That's in isolation. You know, you asked me today, will I vote for united Ireland? My instinctive answer is yes, of course I will.
You get to the white paper about certain services. And
you ask me, will I vote for United Ireland? And by the way, that's going to cost €5 in the pound more on my tax bill because somebody has to replace the British subsidy. You ask people in Northern Ireland, nationalists in Northern Ireland, will they vote for United Ireland? And by the way, that means losing the National Health Service. It means starting to pay for school books. It means no more free visits to the GP.
Who'd have thought school books would become the totem for all of this?
It's a reality. It's a reality. This is something about which I've campaigned for years and years and years. Ireland is the only country in the world that has a constitutional right to free primary education, which starts with an €800 bill for free for what should be free.
Well, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt your segue there about free education. Aoife, what did you make, A, of the criticism about Leo Varadkar's timing, and B, his timing of it? Because, yes, you can say it's the party Ardesh, it's always fine to talk about the future, but this week of all weeks, when there's so much going on, you could maybe say, keep your powder dry for a few days?
Okay, the thing is, too, Leo Varadkar said this in 2016 at the McGill Summer School. Like, he's already said before, I think we'll have a United Ireland in my lifetime. As Justine McCarthy wrote in the Sunday Times today, there is no good time to talk about a United Ireland. And it was pointed out very quickly when Brandon Lewis said it was, you know, a bit problematic or whatever. Why is it allowed that the Conservative Party can run and stand in Northern Ireland and profess to look after the union and promote the union, but it's not all right for Leo Varadkar to say, oh, I would quite like to see a United Ireland? There's a huge double standard there. So I think Fergus is also right about nationalists in the North. And I know in my own community, people would quite like a United Ireland, but they're not going without the NHS. And I do think
they're free school books,
the
apparently.
Other side of it is Leo Varadkar is a very shrewd political operator. And I think with Brexit and everything else that's going on, the writing on the wall is on the wall about unity. The conversation has happened. Like, I fully believe that when RTE mentions it, that's when, you know, it's on the table. Claire Byrne Live had that full TV program about it. So there is a conversation to be had. This notion, and I have written about this before as a Northerner, this notion of talking about changing symbols and changing flags, I am not interested in any of that until you tell me what's going to happen to the NHS, how much it's going to cost. The people in Northern Ireland only really want to know if it's going to make your life better. It appears with everything that's happened to Brexit, Northern Ireland is already, you know, the health service is on its knees. We have a looming housing crisis. So,
but the Northern nationalists would want to know all of that before the question comes.
The people aren't blindly, nationalists aren't blindly walking into United Ireland. I worked in Scotland during the independence referendum and it was the same there. People did want an independent Scotland, but they also wanted the facts, the figures, the totals to tell them what their life is going to be like. And all this chat about symbols and flags and everything else is just gravy when you really need to get on to the meat and potatoes of it.
I would just like to state for the record before I let you go that we were talking about it long before Claire Byrne was. Just to stipulate that right
now.
It is
really, really important though to make the point that, and it has been public policy here and in the UK and in Northern Ireland for 20 years now, a United Ireland comes about by consent and only by consent. And you know, anyone who talks about it outside that context, anyone who talks about it outside that context is not representing reality, and anyone is free to talk about it in that context.
Fergus Finlay, Director of the HSE, and Aoife Moore, Political Correspondent with the Irish Examiner. Thank you both very much for coming into me in the studio.
On the Record with Gavin Riley. On News Talk